With Walmart's new fresh and frozen subscriptions, you can save time on your weekly grocery shopping.
Dad, you're supposed to be grocery shopping.
And miss the chance to embarrass you in front of your friends? I subscribe to snacks and wet napkins. You know how messy you are.
Dad!
Walmart. Subscribe to your weekly list.
This episode is brought to you by Nespresso. Satisfy your iced coffee craving without leaving home with custom blends. From double espressos to cold brew style. Meant to be iced, meant to be simple, and consistently delicious with a touch of a button. Visit Nespresso.com to learn more.
People don't seem to be really aware what these Islamist currents do. The right wing, the religious factions, the conservatives, the Christians, they're nothing. In the Islamic world, Islam is not this poor, cute little minority. Islam is the authoritarian, the totalitarian, the sick, relentless, messed up rule that lynches, locks up, kills people. It's worse over there than anything you have seen here in the UK or in the US. And yet you guys keep ignoring it when you are told about it. And you think, oh no, that's all just racism. It's all just, you know, you just don't like brown people. They adopt this whole different way of talking. It's like, oh yeah, no, it's just, this is a peaceful religion. It's very, you know, everything you heard about it is a lie, Islamophobia.
That's interesting. They code switch, just sort of two different codes for whoever they're speaking to. They put a fatwa on you.
He published a video in which he openly said, speaking to me, that yes, you should be executed.
Hello and welcome to another episode. Today is Apostate Prophet, I'm proud to say, because Apostate Prophet is a huge name on YouTube, and what a lovely, lovely man. I'm so happy I got the chance to meet him. He came to the UK for this and is just a great fella. He's a great fella. His name is Ridvan Idemir. He's better known, of course, as Apostate Prophet. He's an ex-Muslim YouTuber, known for Islamic counter-apologetics, as in those who sort of make apologies on behalf of Islam. He's going, no, hang on. This is quite a dangerous thing indeed. He has garnered a follower base since the beginning, his YouTube in 2017. He was born in Germany to a Turkish family of devout Sunni Muslims. Eventually, Ridvan moved to Turkey, picking up various ideologies. He got the ideologies. I think in every episode now, I make one sillyology while there, such as being a secular communist for a short time. Ridvan served his mandatory military service in Turkey and later became heavily interested in Islam. Raised in a conservative Muslim environment, Ridvan's study in Islam became extensive. However, he also had doubts about Islam and its tenets. Several years went by. Ridvan became more skeptical about Islam until he eventually left Islam altogether. This disappointed his parents, who were conservative Muslims, and he is now estranged from them. Ridvan eventually immigrated to the United States around 2018 and became a US citizen in late 2021. He is married to his wife. This is, I'm reading the YouTube wiki thing. He is married to his wife and has a child. This is all according to that stuff. So who quite knows? Today, rather than look at his personal story, I think we looked at some of the issues of Islam. It's really interesting because people like Ridvan, they really go into things in such a way, it's different each time. I've got Maya Tusi coming on soon, for example, who's another ex-Muslim, and they really speak about things in different ways. They have different parts that they emphasize, and it's just really interesting. Please do go follow Apostate Prophet on YouTube. Go find him as Apostate Prophet, of course, on Twitter as well, on X or whatever. He's got over 100,000 followers. He's a big name in this space, and as he says, stay away from Islam. Well, up to you. Let me know what you think of this. He's very mild-mannered and very interesting, so please do at least hear him out, and I will see you at the end. We've had quite a few people winning political seats from who are Muslims, who are dressed in the whole gear, very vocal about Palestine and shouting Allahu Akbar, which in the UK obviously brings up memories of not just September 11th, but, you know, 7/7 in the UK, the terrorist attacks here. That's what everybody's thinking about all the time. What's going on? Does that surprise you that this is happening?
it doesn't really surprise me. What surprises me is the response, the lackluster response, the lack of response, actually, and the naivety on the part of Western people and British people in general in response to that kind of stuff. So I was very religious at some point, and I left the Islamic faith. And one thing that motivated me to go out there and to speak out and to tell people what Islam really is was that that Islamists, that Muslim preachers and politicians go out there trying to present this beautiful picture of Islam as a, you know, in order to deceive people. And I knew how Islam really is. So I wanted to be one of those who tell people about the truth of Islam because of its terrible impacts and implications. And I still see to this day, despite the fact that information about Islam is so easy to access on the internet, to this day, people don't seem to be really aware what these Islamist currents do, what they aim for, and what they will entail.
Mm-hmm. It was known as, it started being called the religion of peace. And did that start with George W. Bush?
He popularized it. It was kind of his fault, which is very ironic because in the Islamic world, he is hated. Yeah. People hate him. People see him as the devil. I remember growing up, especially after the whole 9/11 issue, of course, he became the face of evil in the Muslim world and everybody hated him. Right. He, on the other hand, is over there in America saying, you know, that it doesn't have anything to do with Islam. Islam is a religion of peace. And, you know, these evil people, they don't represent Islam and Muslims. Of course, he does say that as the president, as somebody who wants to, you know, calm things down and don't create chaos and major backlash, but do you really have to go that far and push such a lie that we then have to deal with collectively?
And now that's just been, I think most people don't even realize that's where it came from, and they think it's something from Islamic texts or something. This is the religion of peace.
Yeah, it doesn't come from Islamic texts. It did, however, exist. So the narrative existed before Bush. It was Islamic organization, what's it, the OCC? So an Islamic organization that unites the Islamic world began spreading this whole idea of Islam being peaceful because at the beginning of the last century, at the beginning of the 20th century, the idea that Islam is a religion of peace did not really exist. But it did become very popular toward the end of the 20th century because the whole narrative of Islam being peaceful and of just, you know, trying to coexist and adapt and whatever really appealed to the Western mindset, which was also changing into a very, very open and tolerant direction toward the end of that century. And people started running with it and popularly just repeating this idea, Islam is a religion of peace. Islam is peaceful. Islam means peace. None of these three things are true. Islam doesn't mean peace. Islam literally stands for submission. You know, surrender, that's what it literally means. Submission, submission to Allah in this case. Islam is not peaceful. In fact, if there is any religion out there that can be described as peaceful, it is definitely not Islam. You could probably list all the religions out there and Islam would be last if it comes to peace. And religion of peace, I mean, that's just a joke. Islam is, fundamentally, Islam relies on spreading the religion by talking, and if it doesn't work by talking, then by fighting and subduing and dominating, presenting Islam as superior and humbling the other religions that should be fought and exterminated or subdued and used as a means of income. This is how it worked in Islamic history. And the Islamists who are running, you know, for offices and who are screaming Allahu Akbar, they're not ignorant of this. They know this. They teach this. They learn this. This is basic stuff that you learn, you know, with an Islamic education. I mean, I grew up learning how great it is and how proud we should be that that the Muslims conquered, that they defeated the Europeans and this and that and spread Islam by conquests. This was taught to me as something fantastic, something great, something to be proud of. And Muslims still learn this kind of stuff. But then when they switch over to talking interreligiously and internationally, they deliberately or even just, I don't know, because mentally something leads to that, they adopt this whole different way of talking. That's like, oh, yeah, no, it's just this is a peaceful religion. It's very, you know, everything you heard about it is a lie, Islamophobia, and so on. No, it's not Islamophobia. The religion was, from the start, spread through fighting, and it continued that way until Islam was forcibly stopped by the West in the 20th century.
That's interesting. They code switch. It's sort of two different codes for whoever they're speaking to.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a very common thing. I mean, I grew up in a household in Germany where I was born, in a religious Turkish Muslim family. So living there as a Turkish person, as a Turkish religious Muslim person, at home, I would learn about how, you know, we Muslims are the good ones and we follow the truth, and all the others, they are evildoers and corrupt, and you can't trust them, and they don't want us Muslims around them, and so on. And then, but when I go to school, it's like, it's just, hey, yeah. I'm a Muslim, just like, you know, and we're just regular people, just like you. No, there's nothing hateful, nothing intolerant, nothing bad about this. You know, you're just misunderstanding it, bro. So,
is there then, because I've not read the Quran or the Bible or the Torah, is it then actually significantly different? Because I always see these examples of horrible things in all of them. So are there more horrible things in the Quran?
It depends on how you define horrible.
That sounds stoning very gaze.
Yeah, sounds very cliche when I say it depends. But here's the thing. There was an analysis many years ago. Somebody online created this whole, putting a program together to see how much violence the Bible contains and how much violence the Quran contains. And then this person put it out there and said there is more violence in the Bible than in the Quran. Yes, there probably is. However, there is a huge difference here, because the Bible is, first off, the Bible is much bigger than the Quran. The Bible is I think 3-4 times bigger than the Quran. The Quran is relatively short, but the Bible, most of it is history. It talks about what happened, talks about what this generation and that generation did, talks about teachings, doesn't give direct commands, but it serves as a guide, while it does also, of course, contain certain do's and don'ts. The Quran, however, is different. The Quran, from the beginning to the end, it is believed and taught to be the direct revelation, the direct speech of Allah, word for word, unchanged, without any interruption or interference, which is not the case with the Bible. In the Bible, it's actually, you know, God revealing things and people then, you know, writing things down, which is acknowledged. But in the Quran, you have commands from the beginning to the end. Everything is taken to be a perfect command, a perfect guide for all humans for all times. And it contains such things like chapter 9, verse 29, which says, fight those who do not believe in Allah or the messenger or the last day and who do not adopt the religion of truth, meaning Islam, from among the people of the book, which means Jews and Christians. So Jews and Christians, if they don't adopt Islam as the religion of truth, and all the others, fight them until they willingly submit and pay the jizya, which is the protection money. Hmm. Protection money. It's not tax, it's protection money. And the purpose of it is, so we Muslims, we rule supreme. We fight you if you don't convert to Islam. And we will make you surrender and pay protection money. As long as you pay that money to us, you will not be harmed. If you fail to pay that, then...
It's like the mafia.
Yeah.
Wow. And is that partly why Islam, I mean, according to Richard Dawkins, Islam is currently 700 years in the past?
I would agree with that, yeah. I would say it's even further in the past. It's like all the developments that you have seen... didn't really happen very much in Islam. And they're also, Islam is fundamentally different from the other religions that we often deal with and talk about. There are problems with Christianity, there are problems with Judaism, there are problems with different religions, but Islam is fundamentally different from those. Those religions, they are meant to create a functioning society that lives in harmony and that finds a way through changing times. And this happens, and it is acknowledged in Jewish history, in Christian history, and so on. It is not that way in Islamic history. It is not that way in Islamic doctrine. On the contrary, Islam is, and Muslims will agree with this if you ask them, Islam is strictly against any kind of change, any kind of adaptation, any kind of, adapting to modernity and all that. Islam is supposed to stay exactly the way it was when Muhammad was alive 1,400 years ago. And this is actually something that Muslims feel proud of. They say it never changed. It is still the same, and it will not stay the same. If you bring any change to it, that is called a bid'ah, an invention, and that is a big sin. It means you are declaring war on Islam, basically.
There's no such thing then as modernizing it.
No.
And yet those who would call themselves the most modern and progressive in society right now seem to be embracing this. I mean, one thing I've started wondering about, I'd never liked the idea of compulsory voting in a country. I don't like that idea. I feel like people say, oh, people died for your right to vote. And I go, yes, for your right to vote, not so that you have to vote, you know? Mm-hmm. So I didn't like that idea. And I only recently started thinking, oh God, but this can be used by nefarious actors. And apparently this happens with other small groups and religions and things like this in other parts of the world, where a religion can, at a mosque, say, hey guys, make sure everyone votes for this guy, and they get in. And that leads into the fears, maybe conspiratorial, maybe not, that Islam or Islamists are trying to take over politically and gradually change things to be that way.
Yeah. Islam has a very deep sense of unity in terms of it being a compulsory unity. You probably have heard of the fact that Islam has a law for apostasy, which means if you leave Islam, that means you need to be executed. I receive confirmations of that all the time because of my outspoken apostasy, my leaving Islam, and my criticism of it. There is a popular Muslim apologist. In fact, one of the most popular Muslim YouTubers, Ali Dawa, he has over 1 million subscribers. He published a video in which he openly said, speaking to me, that yes, you will be you should be executed. And we Muslims, we are all the same. And there is a reason why this is the law. And because you cause corruption by leaving it and announcing it. So
they put a fatwa on you.
Yeah, you should be. So he does say, to be fair, that this wouldn't be happening now by random people, but once they have their way and once they have Islamic laws and they can decide what happens, then I, as an ex-Muslim, would be executed, and they are proud of that.
I like that you say, to be fair. To be fair, he's not so bad. He wants to wait until they've taken over the country to then execute.
Yeah. And I've spoken to them. I talked to them. And so their idea is, if a society, if this country, if the UK gets to a point where Muslims or people who follow Islam can be the majority, or at least can have a say insofar as to decide what kind of government will be in charge, they would then be obligated religiously to implement Islamic laws. And those Islamic laws would include such things as, obedience and respecting Islam, not leaving Islam if you are a Muslim, being killed if you leave Islam, and so on. And these are not just things that they came up with. This is, according to Islamic tradition, Muhammad, the prophet himself, said, whoever changes his religion, kill him directly. That's what he says, according to the hadith, which are the most authoritative, authentic, by Islamic standards, sayings attributed to Muhammad. Wow. So the issue with the whole making everyone vote and making everyone unite is, in Islam, it's not just that this is a religion and you believe in Allah, and if you don't believe anymore, then you are just no longer a Muslim and you go on with your life, that's it. If you leave Islam, that means you have betrayed the Muslim community, the Muslim nation, the Ummah as a whole. You have betrayed your family, your siblings, your your relatives, friends, everything that makes you you, and you no longer really have a right to exist. Mm. And as long as you are a Muslim, you are supposed to be loyal to this common cause, which is why it will be very difficult in global conflicts where Muslims are involved for Muslims to side with the other side or to help the other side in any way. They have to be loyal with the Muslims.
I did this thing with Peter Boghossian, where he gets people's street epistemology to stand on different, strongly agree with a statement, strongly disagree, neutral or whatever. And the statement was, I could be friends with a true believer of Muslim. And I don't like the idea that I can only be friends with people with whom I agree. So I was indifferent. I put myself as indifferent, I think. I can't remember exactly. I'm sure people are watching. No, you weren't. You were slightly different. But I was somewhere like, oh, yeah, maybe. We have different views, but maybe I could be friends with them. And Yasmin Mohammed, you know of her?
Yeah.
She, just wonderful person.
Love her.
Yeah. And she was strongly disagree. And we had to then give our reasons. And I gave my sort of, I don't know. I think we could be friends. La-di-da. And they got to her and she said like, well, they want me dead. They would like to kill me. And then Peter said, does anyone want to move? And I went, oh, I think I have to move towards Yasmin's one as well because they want her dead. Yeah. Like I can't be friends with a person who wants my friend dead. I think that's where I have to draw the line of this sort of acceptance and tolerance.
Yeah.
Bloody hell. And that's something you live with every day. And you're very prominent, perhaps more prominent than Yasmin.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, 2 carry on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink. Grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded. Both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favorite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. Awaytravel.com/heretics.
With Walmart's new fresh and frozen subscriptions, you can save time on your weekly grocery shopping.
Dad, you're supposed to be grocery shopping.
And miss the chance to embarrass you in front of your friends? I subscribe to snacks and wet napkins. You know how messy you are.
Dad!
Walmart. Subscribe to your weekly list.
In a way, I mean, I have a bigger social media or YouTube platform. I would say she is bigger than me in that she's more... A Twitter personality, a more known spokesperson.
You're both huge names, though, and you've both got targets on your back.
Yeah. Okay, we will share it, yes. Yeah.
Bloody hell. But that must create a real bond when you guys meet each other, because it's like, oh, God, we've shared this bond, and you know?
That's the thing. When I was a Muslim, it seemed like there is nobody who leaves Islam. When I was questioning, which took many years, it was very difficult. And when I was about to leave, actually, it seemed like I must be insane. I must be the only person who is questioning and who is going through this process. I don't know what's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. When I left, it still seemed like I'm the only person. And how can I explain myself to people? And once I started looking for the community online, I saw that there are many of them. And unfortunately, many of them are anonymous. Many of them hide behind, you know, different names, without profile pictures.
Understandably.
Yeah. In private communities saying, have to be very careful, not share my information with anyone, not let anyone know that I am. I mean, most of the ex-Muslims that I have interacted with online are still, people who act to their families as if they were still Muslims. Like they go through Ramadan fasting just to pretend that they are Muslims because if they reveal that they are no longer Muslims, that they no longer believe, there are different risks ranging from being treated differently and kind of shunned to getting killed. And I have met quite a few people who, because they were being chased by their families, by their parents, or by their societies, or by their governments, and threatened with death, people who barely escaped death and came to the West and to our ex-Muslims and who still have to hide it. This is what we are dealing with. So, of course, then, you know, seeing each other and talking to each other as ex-Muslims feels good. It feels like you found something to trust. You found someone who actually shares these things with you and who doesn't want to kill you, but who actually...
And shares your courage.
Yeah, shares your courage in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, look, it's unlikely in America, but in Europe, how likely is it, particularly in the UK, that political Islamists could get some sort of power and that people like you and probably me as well would be out?
I try not to be too gloomy about it. But lately... especially with the whole Israel-Hamas war ongoing right now, a lot of the public narrative has become more direct. You can see more what people actually think, what they are actually saying, how they react to things happening in the world. You see where the where society is going when it comes to religion. You see where Islamic society is going within London, within the UK. And I must say, when I... Recently, I looked a little bit at certain Muslim figures and spokespeople and organizations within the UK, and some of them already outright say that, you know, they now have positions of power or they now have the means to influence law, to change things their way. And there was even one person who was speaking, who is part of this this one well-known Muslim organization, which I don't want to mention now, here in the UK, who said something like, well, it's too late for you guys. I mean, if we have the means, we will make use of whatever legal availabilities we have in order to make this society better and get rid of your corrupt ways. And by better, of course, they mean the Islamic better. And the Islamic better is only better for Islamists. It's worse for everyone else. So I must say that while I don't want to think that, you know, everything will be terrible, we will be, you know, run over and ruled and so on, I don't think that Islamists will ever kind of take over and rule over all of us and be in power. I do think, however, that that we have long passed a point from which we could safely return, and there will probably be, you know, major problems in the not so distant future in terms of Islamic rule, Islamic laws under the current government, under this system of government. There could be separatist movements within the UK. It's entirely possible that a movement could emerge which asks for which establishes a separatist goal to have an Islamic state within the British Isles, for example. You know, totally possible. It's not a crazy thing, and I think it's very likely that some major unrest will come as a result of what is happening right now, which is why it's important to inform both non-Muslims and Muslims about the big problems with Islam, in order to not just turn people against Islam, but to turn Muslims away from Islam and to make them leave Islam, to stop going in this destructive, ridiculous, dark direction.
Hence the name Apostate Prophet.
Yes.
You are evangelizing apostasy.
Yes.
A scary position to be in, but I commend you for it.
Maybe I'm just a bit crazy. I don't know, but...
definitely that. Bloody hell. Well, look, I know some people will be listening or watching and saying, oh, come on, you guys are just scared of brown people, or you're just scared of anything that's not Christianity, or whatever it might be. But we have started... I mean, I would advise those people to check out Mothin Ali, who is the guy who just became a counselor, who is just yelling Allahu Akbar. And with, you know, some other Islamists, And I suppose I would differentiate Islamists from Muslims because Islamists seem to, you know, the yelling and shouting. If I saw a bunch of Jews doing that, I'd also be a bit like, you've just taken a seat representing the English people who are primarily not Jewish and you're shouting stuff in Hebrew. I would be going, what are you doing? What are you doing? Like, this is just so divisive. This is ridiculous. Or if I got a seat in Poland, and I'm shouting in English, like, why would I do that if I'm looking after the Polish people or whatever it might be? But people should look that up. Go on, what were you going to say?
In London, I mean, I drove through a Jewish community, a Jewish neighborhood, mm-hmm. and very well known. You drive through there, and what you see is just religious and Jewish population living there. And currently, at the moment, the only concern that they have when it comes to these major crazy politics is, will we be safe here? That's one of the major concerns that they have because of the way things are going right now.
Yeah.
Let's look out for our safety, for each other's safety. They're not going out and saying, oh, look, we have a neighborhood, we have high numbers, we should now do something to take over. The major concern on the religious Islamic side is not will we be safe here, it is how can we change things in such a way that offending our beliefs is no longer allowed and is severely punishable here in the UK? How can we change the laws of the UK and make it more Islamic? How can we make it so that we can do whatever we want in the UK? And so on. This is not an accusation. It's not a conspiracy theory. This is you can see it if you just interact with the Islamist organizations or Islamist speakers and apologists directly. You can ask them and they will tell you. Mm-hmm. I asked them and they told me, and I have it all out there on my YouTube channel in public. It's everywhere. Oh. I also grew up with this whole idea that as religious Muslims, and yes, I want to separate between just regular Muslims and then religious Muslims or Islamists. If you are a religious Muslim, you basically become an Islamist. The regular average Muslim is just a cultural Muslim who doesn't necessarily subscribe to Islamist views. But if you are a religious Islamic person, the belief is you have to live in an Islamic environment, in an Islamic society, or you have to help turn the place that you are in into an Islamic society where Islam is basically in charge. Because in Islam, there are two forms of two values that may rule over you. One is Islam, and the other is corruption or war. So they separate between Dar al-Islam, which means house of Islam, and Dar al-Harb, which means house of war. A place that is not Islamic is by definition a place of war and is corrupt. And you are supposed to change that place into an Islamic place to make it better. Mm. So from their perspective, it's like you are going to a place that is bad, that is sick, that is dark, and you have to change it to make it all green Islamic in order to do the will of Allah.
Interesting.
That is the purpose.
Because I think a lot of people dislike the Jews because the Jews are so uninterested in evangelizing. They're just like, we're doing our thing here. We don't want you as part of
it. Just leave us alone.
We're very exclusive and don't want anyone else in the group. But, and if you want to convert, that's no easy. I mean, I know some people who have, and it's no easy thing. But
yeah. Yeah, I mean the Orthodox Jewish perspective is even that if you want to convert to Judaism, you are thoroughly questioned and even discouraged. Like, why would you want to convert? Why would you want to do this?
Oh man! So I saw this Mothin Ali. I saw all the people around. They're all jumping around and just acting crazy. And then there's one woman who is just a white blonde woman, also happy, but she then gets crowded out. They like go in front of her and she's now at the back, but she was like, you know, helped this happen, and she's so proud and all of that. Now we've seen, this is the Green Party, you won't be surprised to know, it's the left. We've seen this happen before in Iran, right? This is what happened. Yep. The leftists. Yes. So what happened there?
Very, very important, very crucial point. I think people who want to understand the insanities of the left and their collaboration with Islamists should really look into what happened in Iran. So during the Islamic Revolution of Iran, what happened is that communist, socialist movements, leftist movements worked together with the Islamist movement, which was the biggest one, to counter the monarchy, which was depicted as evil and oppressive and vilified, and was like all kinds of conspiracy theories were made about them. And sure, they had their faults. They had their faults. Monarchies that are ruled in such a way, like the way it was in Iran, are bound to get into problems with authority and resistance from within. But what the leftists did there was to collaborate with the Islamists in hopes to establish a democracy and finally be able to elect their own parties, get rid of this seemingly absolute monarchy and establish hope for the future. And it was basically, the propaganda was, we will finally be able to give the people a voice. It will be for the people, for the people, for all of us, for freedom, no longer submission to the Shah, and so on. And the socialists and communists reluctantly but thoroughly worked with the Islamists and helped them with the revolution. But as soon as the revolution succeeded, as soon as they got rid of the monarchy, of the Shah, as soon as they threw them out, the Islamists took control of the situation. So what happens is, of course, the Islamists succeed and they think, okay, guys, we have to be very quick. There is a vacuum. We just overthrew the government. We now have to take power and make sure that all the other factions listen to us and go our way, because we know what's up. So the Islamists take over, take the lead, and immediately start outlawing the ideas that the others who helped them stand for and support, locking them up, making all kinds of allegations about them, saying preventative measures to lock them up, and begin executing them. Oh. In fact, the president of Iran, who just died in a helicopter crash, Ebrahim Raisi, he was on a council that did come into existence almost 10 years after the revolution, but was still part of that whole series of events. Mm. He was on a council of only four people who oversaw the judgment, the persecution, and execution of thousands of people.
Did you see what the BBC said about him?
Mixed legacy.
His mixed legacy. Yeah.
It's like, imagine the BBC wrote an article about Hitler after his death and said, here is the mixed legacy of Adolf Hitler.
Or the mixed legacy of Jimmy Savile.
Yeah. Because that guy sat on a board for the Islamist revolution and executed thousands, if not 10,000s of, by the way, of socialists, Kurdish minorities, socialists, communists, people who helped them with the revolution. They made sure to get rid of them, to chop them up, to let the blood flow so that nobody can oppose their Islamic rule anymore. And this is how they are. And now all leftist, democratic, liberal people coming out of Iran, after, of course, fleeing the country, have become aware and are very, very much anti-Islam, which is why you will see that around the world, the Iranian diaspora is one of the most anti-Islamic and most anti that block at the moment, most pro-Israel at the moment, for example, and so on.
It's just crazy that I remember at school, like history lessons, we learned about the Nazis and that was like it. So I just was armed with this understanding of, don't be right wing. And that was it. There was no understanding of like, oh, sometimes the people who think they're the good guys and you might be wrong. And how have these people on the left now, they've not seen history and they're still supporting this?
It's so naive. It's like we could talk forever about where that comes from and why that happens. I guess there is in left-leaning politics, especially among the younger people, there is a sense of being compassionate and just looking out for those guys who are seemingly being mistreated and oppressed. And of course, if you are in the West, then the Muslims, especially after 9/11, are the ones who are being who are marginalized, who are the minority, who are oppressed, and this and that. So therefore, we should look out for them, we should help them, we should side with them, and so on. What they don't realize is, yes, at some point they are a minority, but once you keep fostering them, if you keep fostering them and helping them rise up and up and up, they will eventually rise higher and higher and higher, take advantage of the situation, and eventually become worse than whatever you have opposed here. The right wing, the religious factions, the conservatives, the Christians, they're nothing compared to what you are feeding there. Because just look at the Islamic world. In the Islamic world, Islam is not this poor, cute little minority. Islam is the authoritarian, the totalitarian, the sick, relentless, messed up rule that lynches, locks up, kills people, beats them into submission, and so on. It's worse over there than anything you have seen here in the UK or in the US. And yet you guys keep ignoring it when you are told about it, and you think, oh no, that's all just racism. It's all just, you just don't like brown people.
Yeah. Despite having no issue with Hindus,
yeah.
Sikhs, nobody yeah. cares. Do what you want. Really bizarre. I want what you just said to be written on like every school, in every school textbook, for people to just understand that. And that Hitchens quote as well, the barbarians never take a city until yes. someone holds the gate open for them.
I love that bit that he... Yeah,
I say that like 10 times a day. I like look in the mirror, I'm like brushing my teeth. Barbarians never take a city. Someone has to hold a gate open for them. I'm like, wow, what an amazing mind. I don't know if he was the first person to say that. I don't know.
He was one of the best. I so often look at the world right now and think, I wish Christopher Hitchens was here right now and he would say something about what's going on. I wonder what he would say about the current current trajectory of religion and all that in the UK, the US, the West.
Man, what can we do to stop this happening, this alliance of the left and political Islamism? Yeah, you're not allowed to say nothing.
The issue is, it's not just the left.
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, for example, in Germany, the major party that fed this whole thing of treating Islam and Islamic minorities and movements with kids' gloves and saying, oh, we just need to do our best to accommodate them and all that. That wasn't the left. It was the supposed Christian conservative party. It was it was Merkel's party. It was the Christian Democratic Union. It was it wasn't leftists who did that. It was the conservatives in charge.
Interesting.
Right now, during this whole Israel-Hamas war, you have leftists and socialists and all that standing up for the Islamists, but you also have a very, very big part of right-wingers that are very hard to ignore at the moment, who have a big problem with Jews and who say, oh, yeah, the Muslims, they're not as bad. We have to focus on the Jews. We should be uniting against the Jews.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Nespresso. Satisfy your iced coffee craving without leaving home with custom blends. From double espressos to cold brew style. Meant to be iced, meant to be simple, and consistently delicious with a touch of a button. Visit Nespresso.com to learn more.
While no one knows what tomorrow may bring, Bridgestone is working toward a more positive outlook. With innovations like developing a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials. It's just one of the many ways Bridgestone is making a difference today for generations to come. Because that's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
In the 2024 Jeep Grand Cherokee L, the journey from point A to point B isn't such a rush. In fact, with three rows of spacious comfort, thoughtfully crafted luxurious design, and an available premium Macintosh audio system, you'll find yourself seeking out the scenic route more often, even if it's just another lap around the block. Jeep, there's only one. Visit Jeep.com to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
In case of, like, there's a YouTube person who wants to ban us or something, Apostate Prophet is saying what other people say.
Yes, yes.
He's not saying the thing. You're right. And he's got a Hebrew thing saying, bring them home now.
For the hostages.
Absolutely. Well, they put the three brackets as well. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Every time I go on anything vaguely conservative, particularly in America, I think there's more of that far right stuff. It's all, Jew, and they got the three brackets, or Andrew, three brackets, gold, and all of this stuff. It's absolutely mad.
It's ridiculous. I am being accused daily nowadays of, I'm saying it already, accused of being a of being a Jew, like it's a horrible thing. And
Well, it would be. If you were sneakily doing it and pretending you weren't to push forward an agenda, I suppose that is an accusation.
Yeah. But it's funny. They come like, oh, you're a Jew. We can see it.
I suppose you could be Jewish.
Maybe.
You could be my cousin, yeah, or something. I would be very proud for you to be my cousin. Yeah. But yeah, well, a lot of people, I'm imagining now the comments already, because I've done a few things where we've mentioned Israel and Palestine, and just it's incredible how much a lot of people who watch just don't want to listen to what you're about to say and will just be saying the word genocide. And what do you say to that?
So Israel and Hamas, wow. It's a very big topic, very big issue that is going on. But right now, the war that is happening since October 7 happened has just brought out the worst in people. It has really muddied things. And I mean, I wake up in the morning and I look at my phone and I open Twitter or X and just see the worst things that people are saying out there, and horrible takes that are totally ahistorical, extremely hateful, pseudoscientific about Jews or Israel or the history that get 60,000 likes, 80,000 likes. You correct it and you get like 1,000 likes or 5,000, because it doesn't matter, because people just want to go with what is popular right now.
Is that, that right wing American guy, Jackson something? He's one of the biggest. I don't know what his name is.
Yeah, Jackson Hinkle. He's one of those people. There are some others like Jake Shields. Then there's this Syrian girl and Suleiman Ahmed. He's one of those people. These people have become, they have really taken advantage of the current war and have really boosted their follower and subscriber and viewer count, and have gone all out there now of being pro-Palestine and increasingly anti-Jewish. It's not just anti-Israel, it's anti-Jewish, let's be honest. It's like...
Well, some would say we're just criticizing the actions of the Israeli government.
I will believe it if some people say, we are only... I have nothing against Jews at all. I am only against certain things that Israel is doing, and I am... other than that, if Israel fixes those things and puts them in order and becomes better, then I'm totally in support of the existence of Israel. If I see that, yeah, sure, I will say, okay, yeah, you don't seem to be genuinely anti-Jewish. You seem to be, okay with it. Just have genuine problems. The thing is, most often, I mean, I go online, I interact with people who say, oh, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm not anti-Jewish, and then it just quickly descends into, why do Jews deserve to have their own state? Why are Jews having their why are there Jewish elements in there
when they're from the States, which is a Christian country?
Yeah, and why is and they aren't even real Jews? They should go back to where they came from, to Poland, and and a distortion of the history in favor of this pro-Palestinian Islamic narrative and all that. It's awful right now.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Because there's actual evidence of, I mean, you can literally see temples, which we know date back thousands of years, that are Jewish temples in Israel. And this idea like, oh no, they're just people from who had never been to Israel. And as if that history isn't, I mean, that history is really complex and nuanced. And, you know?
Yeah, there are different views of, there are different things that people are saying when they accused Israelis of not being real Jews. First off, one thing needs to be pointed out, which is that Ashkenazi Jews, those who people say they go back to Poland, are not even the majority of Jews in Israel at the moment. So it's a very weird thing, but when we keep talking about Ashkenazi Jews, they're not the majority. They were the majority of those who established the modern state of Israel, but they're not the majority right now. It's a big mix of Sephardic Jews, Mizrahi Jews, who are from all over the Middle East, including who were in the land which they call Palestine forever.
It's not a white country then.
Yeah, no. And you have Ethiopian Jews, very, very well known, serving in the military. I talked to several of them, very nice people, very integrated and all that. And but what people mean often is that, yes, there were Jews there in the land, but those Jews are now the Palestinians because they all converted to Christianity and Islam. And so all the others who come from outside, they're not real Jews, they're fake Jews, mm-hmm. which is just ridiculously ahistorical. We have the scientific evidence, the genetics. We already have established all the ties of the Jewish diaspora back to the land. Ashkenazi Jews have ties to the land, has been established. There is an ethnic, cultural, ancestral tie that goes back and unites these people once again. And Jews lived in this in that land forever. Hebron is one of the cities where Jews lived uninterrupted until the 20th century, where, by the way, in 1929, a big pogrom, a massacre took place against Jews of Hebron, and they were forced to flee. But they were there for forever, not being treated very well under Islamic rule, but they were there. They persisted. Now everything is just crazy. You have this Palestinian population that whose history doesn't go very far back, who are very mixed people. Many of them came in through the Islamic conquests, mixed in with the local population, and who now claim that they have this, that they are indigenous to this land, and that they have lived there forever, and that this land belongs to them. I don't know if you want to go further into the whole this whole issue, into the whole history of it, but
I think that's pretty. I think you covered it really well, actually. I think that seems that. I mean, look, ultimately, part of me feels like when people do go on about that, when they go on about the 1948, was it, or 49, when Israel was established, and
48,
and so I don't know if there's any other country in the world, firstly, that was formed without some kind of controversy. Right? I mean, every country ever in the world was formed after either killing a bunch of natives, doing even worse things to their women, all sorts of disputes. I mean, look at Pakistan. That's just crazy how countries have, and no other country in the world do people so regularly say it doesn't have a right to exist.
Well, it's because it's Jews. I mean, there are lots of conflicts right now in the world. There are lots of wars in the world. There's a lot of chaos in the world. We only talk about this one conflict all around the world whenever something happens there, and it's the Israel conflict, the Israel's fight with the others, and it's because it's Jews. And I understand that. Look, I grew up as a Muslim in a religious Muslim household. We have established that. The one thing that that is very, very significant about that, which I guess kind of maybe influenced my current activism and my will to support Jewish people and to support Israel, the one thing that was very dominant in this Muslim household was also the anti-Semitism, the hate for Jews. And I grew up with it. Muslims around the world grow up with it. If you don't believe me, everybody knows about Mehdi Hassan. Nobody knows who I am. Everybody knows who Mehdi Hassan is. Mehdi Hassan wrote an article, I think about 10 years ago or so, which he titled something about, it's something about anti-Semitism. He was a little bit more reasonable back then.
Yeah.
And he, the whole article is basically, he says there that anti-Semitism is common in every Muslim household. It is at the dinner table. And he even says, every Muslim who is, you know, honest with himself knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's everywhere. You go home, you sit down for dinner, and everybody at the table is anti-Semitic. Everybody has crazy, crazy anti-Jewish conspiracy theories. I grew up with those. I grew up when I was a little child. When I was in first grade, we went to a religious gathering over the weekend where I was informed that soon a time may come where we will fight the Jews and we will kill the last of them, and they will be hiding behind rocks and trees. And I was taught about that when I was in first grade. I was a little child, and I went back to school on Monday telling my best friend about that and thinking that it's actually real and it's actually going to happen. And this is not something that just my family or my religious community or people came up with. This is once again something that goes back to none other than Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad himself. According to authentic reports, and Muslims around the world know this because they will mention this when they don't speak in English, or sometimes they will also mention it in English. Muhammad himself made a prophecy according to the authentic hadith where he said, the world will not, the hour will not come, will not be established, the last hour, until you fight the Jews, and the Jews will hide behind rocks and trees. And even the rocks and trees will talk and say, Muslim, servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him, except for one tree, the Gharqat tree, which is the tree of the Jews. That tree will not tell. I know it sounds very ridiculous talking rocks and trees, but this is...
That's religion. I don't mean to offend everybody who's listening who's religious. I think half the audience is, and I respect their beliefs, but they know that in their religious text they have talking trees and snakes and things, and that's just how it is. And fine. And look, I agree with you. I mean, look, I go in, I always ask people, because that is something about Jews, is that we can pass, and sometimes, and often in taxis and Ubers and things, if the person driving is apparently Muslim or something, I will often ask their thoughts on Jews and things, because I'm just intrigued when they don't know what I am. And the stuff they think, I almost feel sorry for them, because it's not their fault. They've been told this stuff, and they really believe it. And if you believe that the Jews, it's all like, eating babies and the blood of this and the blood, they go, you know, I've heard they do that, and you know, we've got to stop these guys doing it. And I'm sitting there like, wow, this poor guy like believes that thing. What can you do about that?
And you know, the Jewish community, you know what it is to be Jewish. Doesn't it seem extremely bizarre to speak to people who have these fantasy views about Jews and what Jews are doing and who they are?
They're so secular, the Jews. They're just like secular people, just the ones I know anyway. And I'm sure there's all sorts of conspiracies people have got, some people who are watching, but most people are very kind and nice.
But you're just pretending to be secular. In fact, you are secretly trying to...
Mossad agent.
Yeah, controlling the world and taking names.
I would love to. But look, I've said this before on the podcast, but like that myth of like controlling the world kind of thing is so compelling that I feel very much that sometimes I start to think maybe it's true, and it would just be typical that I'm the one they just left out, and I'm left out, and they're all secretly giving each other jobs and I'm not.
Well, here's the thing. I went to Israel quite recently, a few months ago, and people have been accusing Israel of being kind of racist and discriminating and so on. I have to say that they are a little bit racist, and they do discriminate, because when I went there, I asked people about controlling the world and how I can be part of it. Nobody told me how to do it. Obviously, it's because I'm not Jewish.
Oh, bloody hell.
So this is...
Yeah. Look, you know what, though? The serious point there, there probably is like racism in Israel. There probably is bad treatment of certain people and minorities and things, just as there is in many other countries. And, you know, it's a country.
There is everywhere. Everywhere you have that. And I'm sorry, but I grew up in... I lived in Turkey. I'm from the Turkish culture. I haven't seen a culture more racist than Turkish people. In Turkey, ultra nationalism is a thing. Every Turk is taught to be proud of his blood and proud of being Turkish. And speaking of different people, especially of Armenians and Greeks and others and Jews, even of Arabs, actually, you know, it's very funny, because Turkey is a Muslim nation, but often they speak of Arabs very disparagingly.
We're all just tribes, man.
Yeah,
just and tribes.
The thing is, the things that people in Turkey say when it comes to racism, if the average person in Europe heard it, they would probably have a heart attack or something. I don't know.
But I used to live in Argentina, and like they're shocked when they come here, and they're like, wait, you're telling me I can't say this? I can't say that? But he is this thing, you know. I'm like, no, you can't say it here. What do you mean? So, yeah, just mad. And then we're told that Britain's like the most racist country. And like only someone would say that if they literally are xenophobic themselves and have some sort of British exceptionalism. You know, like we're so, because they've never been anywhere else. They never got out of their house. They don't get out of their pajamas enough, as Douglas Murray says about people.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You need to get out of your pajamas. Quite quickly, is Israel committing genocide?
No.
Less quick than that.
Well, I thought we were done. Yeah. definitely not. Most definitely not. And there are many different layers to it. But first off, just because you call it a genocide, it doesn't mean it's a genocide. You have to establish establish the facts and establish reasons for why you call it a genocide, to then declare it a genocide. You have to establish genocidal intent. One of the things that is currently going on is with the ICJ, the International Court of Justice. The case that is brought against Israel is that Israel is committing a genocide against the Palestinian people. What needs to be established there, however, is that Israel actually has genocidal intent. And what that means is not that Israel caused many Palestinians to die or caused many civilians to die. Happens as part of war. What needs to be established is that Israel was actually deliberately going with genocidal intent, meaning aiming for the destruction of this population in part or in whole, systematically, or that Israel was indifferent to preventing a genocide from happening as a result of their means. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can even remotely establish any such facts, and you can. I'm definitely sure that there is no way that you can actually establish that Israel has genocidal intent, or that they had genocidal intent during this war or at any part of this conflict. Of course, you can go to certain figures within the Israeli government or the public and say, "Look, they said something that sounds genocidal." Okay, fine, but Israel as a state, the IDF as an army, people who are actually in charge, did they intend to commit a genocide? Are they intending to commit a genocide? You can't establish that. It's not there. Israel is doing whatever they can to prevent civilian casualties. You have it. I mean, they went into Gaza weeks after announcing again and again and again, relocate to these regions, go to these regions, drawing maps. I mean, think about this. Israel is actually using their resources to create maps and elaborate, you know, paths to relocate civilians. They call them in their homes, say, "You must get out, must get out." They say, "I won't leave, don't call me anymore." Israel still calls them and tells them, "You must get out." Mm. Drops flyers, does these knock things explosions above certain places to indicate we are going to fight here soon, so leave. If as a result of that, people still stay in their place and then die under the rubble, and it's very hard to talk about these things because children die, women die, innocent people seemingly die. However, by international law, what is looked at is, did Israel do whatever they can to prevent these civilian deaths from happening? Yes, they did put in significant effort. If they did put in significant effort, but if the civilians did not abide, did not listen, and caused their own deaths or caused the deaths of their own families, it's not Israel's fault. Yeah, Israel is waging a war.
I think of like the Hutus in Rwanda, the Tutsi and the Hutus. And I remember that film, Hotel Rwanda, just horrible to watch that film. But yeah, if they'd gone to a village, like instead of going and killing everyone, said, "You guys need to leave. Like, we're just looking for the bad guys here." I mean, that film would have had a very different, and that actual war would have had a different feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember, Coleman Hughes, I remember saying on Joe Rogan that the civilian death rate is actually significantly lower than that of America in Afghanistan and Iraq.
There is a thing, there is a lot of disinformation going on, but recently, I'm not going to trust everything directly what spokespeople or what the government is saying. Mm-hmm. However, Israel did recently say that by their estimations, there is almost a 1-to-1 combatant to non-combatant ratio in of deaths in Gaza. If true, that is extremely impressive. Hmm. Netanyahu said, "We killed 14,000 Hamas members and 16,000 civilians so far, which is very unfortunate, but this is the ratio," he said. If that is true, that is extremely impressive. That means under the circumstances, it would be expected that they would kill significantly more civilians than militants. Mm. If this is the ratio, this is extremely impressive and shows that Israel is doing their best to minimize civilian casualties. Mm. That said, of course, I can't just take their word as it is. We have to see the numbers. We have to see the results. But even if it is a 2-to-1 combatant to or non-combatant to combatant ratio, that is a, I don't want to use the word good here, but this is not an extraordinarily bad number. On the contrary, it is quite consistent with the history of wars, especially in fighting in such a place like Gaza that is so densely populated, with buildings that are so attached to each other, with Hamas that deliberately, in their own words, people don't believe it when Israel says they're using them as human shields, but they openly, they go on TV saying that they do build tunnels under the population to fight, and they are happy to sacrifice martyrs because Palestinians, we are a nation of martyrs. That's what they say. That's what their leaders say. Under such circumstances, keeping the rate so low is very impressive on Israel's behalf. If people say this is a genocide, they don't know what they're talking about, or they're being dishonest.
It's just a scary, scary world of disinformation. Where can people, I've got another question for you, but where can people go and find your excellent work?
Thank you. But they can find it on mainly on YouTube, Apostate Prophet, almost at 500,000 subscribers now. I think 1,000 away from it. So
that's amazing. That's amazing. Hopefully today I'll get there. I've got a couple of days.
Yes.
Who is a heretic you admire?
There are lots of them. Recently, Mossab Hassan Youssef, who is a former Hamas member.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's been speaking out against Hamas.
He's very, very brave and very solid. He switched sides. He was in prison, worked for the Israeli intelligence to prevent terrorist attacks and all that. He saved lives. He's a genuine hero.
Amazing.
Him, definitely. Yasmin Mohammed is another one.
Both amazing heretics. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ridvan Idemir, or Apostate Prophet. Guys, go follow him on Twitter. Go follow him on YouTube. Go see what he's saying, because he is just such an interesting, a fascinating person. He came all the way to the UK for this episode. So I appreciate that very much. And I hope that you guys really, give him a bit of support and everything. Did you find that interesting? Are there parts you disagree with or agree with? You can let me know on Spotify. There's a place now where you can put comments and things. Let me know on Apple subscriber, whatever, although that's more of a, not Apple subscriber, just Apple podcasts. That's where you can, that's more for the whole podcast in general, but leave a review. Please do that. That would be very much appreciated. And because it helps me get bigger guests if I have more reviews and things like that. And I will see you guys next time.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Introducing your kids to finances and gift cards can be quite a task. You don't want to limit them with traditional gift cards that only work for one specific store, or give them a credit or debit card and have them run unsupervised. But don't worry, because something epic is here. The Epic Gift Card is a gift card for kids and teens that lets them spend safely and securely. The Epic Gift Card was created with kids and teens in mind, letting them freely use it at virtually any age-appropriate retailer they want. Epic was developed by experts to ensure it's perfect for your kids, giving you relief that it'll be used responsibly while they get to buy exactly what they want. From celebrating their daily victories to preparing them for a future financial responsibility to giving them a fantastic gift. With Epic, the sky's the limit for your kids. Visit epiccard.com today to learn all about this incredible gift card. That's EPIK card.com. EPIK card.com.